We're nearing the end of the book of Judges, and last time we covered the end of the story of Samson. Certainly Samson was a remarkable individual in many ways, and remarkable that God was able to use the man as he did, not a man that demonstrated a lot of great spirituality, or even wisdom at times, it would seem. But it is reflective of the way that the society was in the days of the judges, when everyone did that which was right in their own eyes, and when the way of God was administered and lived with not the greatest purity and focus and wisdom. We're going to see that again as we get into Judges chapter 19. The history here as we start in chapter 19 is not necessarily a direct connection with what happened in the preceding chapters, which described how it was that the tribe of Dan moved from their original inheritance on the coastline up to the very northern part of Israel, taking over an innocent city called previously Laish that they found because they didn't get into their inheritance. They couldn't get into their inheritance because it was on the coast. And for whatever reason, they didn't follow faithfully God. And God didn't bless them with the opportunity to take and hold the land. So they went and found their own place, kicked the people out, burned their city down, and occupied it themselves. And in the process, established a competing, you might say, religious system up at Dan, establishing as a priest one who never should have been a priest. And this is long before Jeroboam and the divided monarchy, when Jeroboam later on made Dan a center of that syncretistic form of worship that was competitive with what God had going on down in Jerusalem. So, very interesting and remarkable story. And even though we start here in chapter 19, it's not necessarily a continuation of what happened beforehand. We'll pick it up in verse 1. It came to pass in those days, when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote mountains of Ephraim, and he took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. Now, it's easy to stop at this point and say, well, okay, here we go. Obviously, even the Levites were off track and taking concubines and blah, blah, blah. But I think it's important for us to recognize here that in the context of the society at this day, having a concubine was not necessarily an immoral relationship. A concubine at that time was more like a secondary wife, and multiple wives were common at the time. The same fidelity toward a wife was expected toward a concubine, a known concubine like this. And all of the responsibilities of husband and wife would apply between the two in the relationship. What the concubine lacked, as opposed to a second wife, would be that the concubine did not have rights of inheritance or endowment. And that was just the way it was in the society. So when we read that the Levite had a concubine, we don't necessarily take from that that this was some way an immoral relationship in the context of the day. It's just like she was a second wife, but second class wife as well, without an inheritance or endowment. Now, he took her from Bethlehem. He was living in Ephraim, which was a middle north part of the country. Bethlehem was about 5 miles south of Jerusalem. It wasn't Jerusalem then, it was Jebus. It was a Canaanite city. And even though Jebus had been taken by Joshua during the conquest, here it is just a generation later, and it's Canaanite again. They had lost the city, they weren't able to hold it. And I say a generation later, as we'll see, the time frame for this story, even though it appears at the end of the book of Acts, the story doesn't take place at the end of the period of the... I said Acts, didn't I? No wonder everybody's looking at me with that blank stare. Even though the story takes place near the end of the book of Judges, the Acts of the Judges. How's that? That's the way I can get around that one, right? Even though it appears at the end of the book of Judges, the story doesn't take place at the end of the time frame of the Judges. We'll read later on here in the context that it actually took place fairly early on in the period of the Judges. Now, Bethlehem is also where the next book of the Bible takes place, the book of Ruth. That's the center point of the book of Ruth. And, of course, we know that Bethlehem was later the place where Christ was to be born. So there was a Levite staying in the mountains of Ephraim, and he took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah to the south. But his concubine played the harlot against him and went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah, and she was there for 4 whole months. Now, well, let's read the next verse. And when her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and bring her back, having his servant and a couple of donkeys with him. And so she brought him, she brought him into her father's house. And when the father of the young woman saw him, he was glad to meet him. Now, let's ask the question, what's your impression of the Levite from these very brief verses? We don't have a lot to go from, but what's the impression that's left to you about the Levite? Anybody? Forgiving. He's forgiving. He's speaking kindly to her, trying to bring her back. All right. We could say he seems like a decent man, perhaps. We don't know really. I mean, it says that she played the harlot. Does anybody have a different translation for that portion? Anybody? Nobody's got it rendered differently in your Bible. It's interesting that many of the commentators will point to the Jewish translators and other sources and say that we aren't necessarily to presume that she actually had illicit sexual relationships with someone other than the Levite. It might mean, and I don't have a personal feeling on this strongly one way or the other, but many of the commentators will say that it might simply mean that they had an argument and she left him and went back to dad, and was there for either 4 months or a year and 4 months, and there's some ambiguity in the Hebrew as to how long that period of time was. If it was a year and 4 months and it took the Levite that long to go back and get her, that seems a little excessive to me. Again, there's some ambiguity in the scripture there. In any case, they were separated either because she, but clearly she was unhappy in some way, either found somebody else to make her happy and ended up going back and living with her father, or they had a fight, and who knows. But they were separated for some period of time, and she was back living with her dad. He decided to see if he could go speak kindly to her, which would be the right thing to do, and try to restore their relationship. He brought a servant, a couple of donkeys, went to her father's house. She apparently met him on the way and brought him to her father, which may indicate that there was at least a cordial relationship there. She wasn't harboring some grudge or something against him at that point. She brought him to dad. Verse 4. Now his father-in-law, the young woman's father, detained him, and he stayed with him 3 days. And so they ate and they drank and they lodged there. It's often common when somebody's trying to detain somebody that eating and drinking goes along with that, you know, feasting and perhaps getting them a little bit difficult to leave is a good way of making them stay. Happy hour. Yes, offering happy hour, extended happy hour, 3 days here. They ate and they drank and they lodged there, and it came to pass on the fourth day that they arose early in the morning, and he stood to depart. But the young woman's father said to his son-in-law, refresh your heart with a morsel of bread, and afterward then go your way. So apparently they had agreed he would stay there for 3 days, detained that long. At the end of the 3 days, he said, okay, time's up, I'm going. It's interesting, Ben Franklin once said, fish and visitors stink after 3 days. But So he figured he'd worn out his welcome now. Father-in-law was happy to see him, and if he doesn't get going here soon, he's going to wear it out. Well, father-in-law was very happy to have him and wanted him to stay longer for some reason. And so at the end of 3 days, the morning of the fourth day, he tried to get him to stay again. Refresh your heart with a morsel of bread, and then later go. Now, he really didn't have any intention of wanting him to go. He was saying, I'm going to keep him around as long as I can today until it gets too late in the day for him to leave, and so I'll keep him another day, at least that way. So they sat down, the two of them ate and drank together. There you go, keep him there one way or another. And the young woman's father said to the man, please be content to stay all night now and let your heart be merry. It had gotten too late in the day for him to head out on his journey. I mean, he was leaving from Bethlehem, 5 miles south of Jerusalem, and he had to get up into the remote mountains of Ephraim. That was a healthy day's trip. So he would want to get out early start for that journey. And when the man stood to depart, verse 7, his father-in-law urged him, and so he lodged there again that night. And he arose early in the morning on the fifth day to depart. But the young woman's father said, please refresh your heart. So they delayed until afternoon, and both of them ate. And it doesn't say, and they both drank, but we can assume it went together. It did always before. And when the man stood to depart, he and his concubine and his servant, he'd been packed now for days, ready to go. Then his father-in-law, the young woman's father, said to him, look, the day is now drawing toward evening. Please spend the night. See, the day is coming to an end. Lodge here, that your heart may be merry. In other words, drink some more. Tomorrow, go your way early, so that you may get home. So he keeps trying to delay him. Any ideas why the father-in-law didn't want him to leave? Anybody have any thoughts on that? I mean, there's hospitality, that's one thing. And the culture required hospitality. And I don't know how much of the culture is being reflected in this, but the host is always supposed to always have the open door of hospitality, and so you have to excuse yourself and finally say no. Whether there was some other reason, I don't know. I really don't know. Commentators seem to be fairly blank on explanations for that. But in any case, on this fifth day, he's no longer able to prevail upon the son-in-law to stay. Even though it's late in the day, and he should have started his journey long before, he decides it's time to go. Verse 10. However, it says the man was not willing to spend that night, and so he rose and he departed, and he came to opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem, and with him were the two saddled donkeys. His concubine was also with him. Now, he was probably thinking, if I don't get out of here tonight, I'm never going to get out of here, and I'll find some place to camp along the way. I'm not going to make it all the way to Ephraim, but I've got to get out of here. And they were near Jebus, verse 11, and the day was far spent. And the servant said to his master, I realize it's only a 5 mile trip from Bethlehem to Jebus. So they probably made it in an hour and a half or so, especially with their donkeys, you know, carrying weight. That's a fairly easy amount of time to cover. So you realize they left late in the day, certainly. And the servant said to his master, come, please, and let us turn aside into this city of the Jebusites, and let's lodge in there. But his master said to him, we will not turn aside here into a city of foreigners who are not of the children of Israel. We'll go on to Gibeah. Now, Gibeah was about 4 miles north of Jerusalem. They were going to circle the city and continue on the road until they got to the next Israelite town. You'd think that was a reasonable thing to do, right? Was that a good decision? Would you have made the same decision? Think about it. I mean, the Jebusites had stolen their city back. Probably not the best relationship. If you had a chance to stay at your family's house or at a stranger's house, where would you stay? Right? So they went on to the family. You'd think that's a good decision. Verse 13. So he said to his servant, come, let us draw near one of these places and spend the night either in Gibeah or in Ramah. And they're both, again, on the road a little bit north of Jerusalem. Both of them Benjamite towns. And they passed by and went their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. And they turned aside there to go in to lodge in Gibeah. And when they went in and sat down in the open, he sat down in the open square of the city, for no one would take them into his house to spend the night. Now think about it. No, we'll pass this stranger's city. We'll go to at least be among our own people, our brethren, and we'll spend the time there. I'm a Levite. They're Benjamites. You know, this will be better. And so you show up on the doorstep, and there's nobody willing to take them in. Nobody. Now, sometimes people come to a church congregation and they feel like they aren't greeted well and there's a cold congregation. Imagine this. This is the cold city of Benjamin, right? They're turned away completely from anybody's hospitality. This does not bode well. And so just then, an old man came in from his work in the field at evening, who was also from the mountains of Ephraim. So this is a real close relative, like not a blood relative, but somebody at least from the same neighborhood. And he was staying in Gibeah, whereas the men of the place were Benjamites. So I'm from Ephraim, you're from Ephraim. You know, we've got something in common here. We're in a strange town of Benjamites, even though they shouldn't be strangers in that sense. They should be brethren. And when he raised his eyes, he saw the traveler in the open square of the city, and the old man said, "Where are you going, and where do you come from?" So he said, "We're passing from Bethlehem in Judah toward the remote mountains of Ephraim. I'm from there. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and now I'm going to the house of the Lord, but there is no one who will take me into his house." So note where he was going. He was going to the house of the Lord. The house of the Lord was then being kept in Shiloh. That's where the tabernacle was located, which is in Ephraim, about 20 miles north of Jerusalem. So he was heading home to his own territory, the remote areas, but by way of going to the tabernacle, to the house of God, possibly to stop there to offer thanks to God for restoring his concubine and the relationship there. Maybe he was going back there to restore or to perform some of his Levitical duties. As a Levite, he would have had them on a rotating basis at the tabernacle. And perhaps that's one reason why he refused to stay longer, because he had to go and fulfill his Levitical duties there at the tabernacle. We don't know exactly what the reason was, but in any case, his intention was to go to the house of God. He said in verse 19, "Although we have both straw and fodder for our donkeys, and bread and wine for myself, for your female servant and for the young man who is with your servant, there's no lack of anything." So he said, we've got everything we need to take care of ourselves. We aren't going to be an imposition or a burden on anybody, and still nobody's willing to even let us have a room. That's cold. That's cold. And the old man said, "Peace be with you. However, let all your needs be my responsibility. Only do not spend the night in the open square." Now, maybe the man knew something about this town, and he didn't want them just hanging out, you know, on the corner. So he said, "Come spend the night at my place. I'll take care of you. You don't even need to use any of your own stuff." So he brought him into his house, and he gave fodder to the donkeys, and they washed their feet, and they ate, and they drank. And as they were enjoying themselves, suddenly certain men of the city, perverted men. What is another translation anybody has? What is it? Homosexual men. Anybody have anything else?
Sons of Belial.
Sons of Belial. Yeah, and that's a common expression for people that are perverted and evil. These perverted men surrounded the house, and they beat on the door. They spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring out the man who came to your house, that we may know him carnally." And imagine, This is what he probably thought he was going to be avoiding by not going into Jebus, but going into a city of Israelites where ostensibly they're going to be God worshippers and following the laws of God, and this is what he's confronted with. So this is a hideous situation, and it should sound familiar. Does it sound familiar? Why? Sodom, right? The city of Lot, thank you. The name wouldn't come to me there for a second. So this is the sickness of Sodom that has now infected this city of Benjamin. Maybe he would have done better to have stayed in Jebus after all. And maybe that's the reason for this story being included in the scriptures. He was expecting to find more hospitality among the Benjamites. And instead, he's confronted with less hospitality, and not just less hospitality, but greater perversion than he would have anticipated even in the other Gentile city. Have you ever been hurt by those that you expected would be your better friends, your closer friends? It's probably happened to all of us at some time or another, where you expect a certain level of respect or friendship or whatever, and it kind of slaps you in the face when that's not what you get. How do you handle that? It's not an easy thing. Verse 23, the master of the house went out to the people who were banging on the door, and they said, and he said to them, this is not the way you would want to handle being confronted today. He said, "No, my brethren, I beg you, do not act so wickedly, seeing this man has come into my house. Do not commit this outrage." Okay, good so far, right? Then he goes on, verse 24, "Look, here's my virgin daughter and the man's concubine. Let me bring them out now and humble them and do with them as you please, but to this man do not do such a vile thing." You can hardly even fathom this, right? And yet, this is a very familiar sounding story because it's almost a repeat of what happened in Sodom. And you think, well, that was Sodom. They were Gentiles. They didn't have God's law. They weren't even trying to follow God's law. But this is Israel. This should never happen. It's hard to even fathom. But the men wouldn't listen to him, and so would not heed him. But they did take his concubine, and they brought her out to them, and they knew her and abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, then they let her go. How could you live with your conscience after having done that? I can't imagine. It's a hideous situation. And yet, what do you do in the face of a mob? Sometimes people do things they wouldn't do when they're scared, or when it appears that your life might be in danger, or the life of your host, or whatever is threatened. It can be a scary thing. And they clearly didn't think straight about this situation. They weren't thinking God's law, what should they do according to God's law. And it was just a terrible, terrible mistake. Verse 26. No, I'm not there yet, am I? Where did I leave off? I'm sorry. I left my finger go. I lost my place. Oh, there I am. I'm in the wrong chapter. No wonder it didn't look right. Yes, there we go. So then the woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was until it was light. So apparently she had some life left in her. But it passed from her as she was lying there with her hands on the doorstep. And when her master arose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go his way, there was his concubine fallen at the door of the house with her hands right on the threshold. And he said to her, "Get up and let's be going." Can you imagine? "Get up and let's go." But there was no answer. And so the man lifted her into the donkey, and the man got up and went to his place. So he finally ended up back at home again. Can you imagine? "Get up, let's go." I don't know what he was thinking or feeling at that point. Maybe he was just glad that she was there, and they were trying to get out of there as quickly as possible. He didn't realize that she was dead until she didn't respond. But he lifted her onto the donkey, and off they went back toward his home. When he entered his house, then he took a knife, he laid hold of his concubine, and divided her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. Now, she was dead already. He didn't kill her to do this. But he was obviously thoroughly upset and was going to send a message to all Israel to bring to their attention the terrible, terrible abuse that had happened here in this city. Who else did something similar? What do you think? A similar account? Hold your finger here. Let's turn to 1 Samuel 11. 1 Samuel chapter 11. Now, this isn't necessarily a person that gets cut up, but 1 Samuel 11 and verse 4. The messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and told the news in the hearing of the people, and all the people lifted up their voices and wept. Well, let's go back a little bit. Verse 1. Nahash the Ammonite came up and encamped against Jabesh-Gilead, and all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, "Make a covenant with us, and we will serve you." And Nahash the Ammonite answered them, "On this condition I will make a covenant with you, that I may put out all your right eyes and bring reproach on all Israel." Why their right eyes? That's your sighting eye for a bow. So he was taking all the warriors. He was going to put out their eyes so that they couldn't at least fight anymore, at least not use a bow. They would be defiled that way. And so the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and told the news in the hearing of the people, and all the people lifted up their voices and wept. Now there was Saul coming behind the herd from the field, and Saul said, "What troubles the people that they weep?" And they told him the words of the men of Jabesh. And then the Spirit of God came upon Saul, and when he heard this news, and his anger was greatly aroused, and so he took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces and sent them throughout all the territory of Israel by the hands of messengers, saying, "Whoever does not go out with Saul and Samuel to battle..." Now, Samuel hadn't been involved yet. He just involved Samuel. But Saul always felt like he needed some support from the prophet, whether the prophet was there to give it or not. He always had to lean on him that way. And so he said, "Whoever does not go out with Saul and Samuel to battle, so it shall be done to his oxen." And the fear of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out with one consent. So Saul, trying to stir up the people against this Ammonite threat, finally decided to do something, and in order to raise an army, he threatened all of Israel. He said, "Come out with me to battle, or I'm going to chop up all your assets." And I'm the king, so you better do it. So I don't think that's the most favorable way to get an army together. But he, I don't know, maybe remembered that it was effective for this Levite in getting people to respond, and he did something similar. Certainly it came later on. And it involved Jabesh-Gilead, which we'll see is an interesting thing as well. And anyway, can you imagine the indignation and the anger that this Levite had after just having been restored his concubine? His family was back together again. He was going home, and on the way home at a supposedly friendly city, this is what happens. He would have been furious. Who wouldn't be? But look at what he did now. Verse 30 says that, "So it was that all who saw it said, 'No such deed has been done or seen from the day that the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day.' consider it, confer, and speak up. So it got a reaction from the people. They were all appalled at what had happened to Gibeah. But is this the way to adjudicate a crime? I mean, were there not laws in Israel that God had given that if a violation of the law occurred, there should have been a way to deal with it, right? Is this the way to adjudicate a crime? Raise up an army or a posse, as the case may be? What should he have done? He was a Levite. He should know the law. He should have known what God's requirements were. Was there not, well, there was no king to bring your case to. That was a problem. But was there not a high priest? Was there no way to make or render a judgment against those who were clearly at fault here? Instead, he kind of took things into his own hands, didn't he?
He was only one guy.
He's only one guy, but boy, he sure stirred up a lot of people.
But he was only one person, right? And he had all these other guys that were doing all the best. So maybe...
So,
he thought, well, he better save his own skin.
But what does this tell us? What does this tell us about the nature of the time of the judges? There was no place that you felt like you could go to get judgment rendered or justice rendered. And if he was angry, he was going to take things into his own hands and stir up whatever he could in order to render what justice he felt was needed. That's no way to adjudicate a crime. That's a way to lead to catastrophe, ultimately.
What I don't understand is he was going to be nice to her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, he was going after her if he wanted her back. And then for him to do that, I mean, put her out there, you know. I don't understand some of these things.
Well, and perhaps there's a lot that we don't understand. But his host was willing to do that as well. And his own virgin daughter, his host was willing to put out there. I mean, as a father, I can't fathom that. But they were willing to.
And then they slept. When they arose,
yeah. It's almost mind-boggling. It is truly almost mind-boggling. But in the... Sorry?
They were probably so removed from God that they could not trust that God would take care of that and no need to, for him to pull
yeah.
out.
Think about this, though, too. Even today, there are certain societies where life is not valued the way we do. And people are willing to sacrifice their kids, sometimes for a holy cause, you know, in a jihad or something like that. You have a kid that goes out wearing bombs on him, blow himself up, and, you know, my son just made it into the land of 72 virgins and all this stuff, and they have these imaginings. Maybe, you know, how do you do that? How do you do that in your mind? At least they can justify that thinking it's a godly thing to do. This was, you know, the godly thing is to at least show hospitality to your guest, even if it means the loss of his concubine. How do you... Somehow your mind does weird things, makes irrational judgments. But then, in spite of the fact how evil this whole situation was, his handling of the situation is not any better. There was a crime. He was the victim of a crime. His family was the victim of a crime. It was a terrible abuse. It needed to be dealt with. But rather than going to some justice of law, he stirred everybody up into a war. It's amazing. Do we do this today? Do we get angry and then take to ourselves the get on our high horse, our righteous indignation horse, and stir up a war instead of taking it to the appropriate place to get it dealt with? Have we not seen that happen? I think, sadly, that's what we all tend to do, acting emotionally rather than rationally. You know, first thing we do is we gossip or we tell somebody how wrong we've been, and we get everybody else as upset as we are, and all of a sudden it's a battle going on. So I think there's a lesson for us to this day. As we look at this man and say how wrong it was what he did, we should look at ourselves too and say it's easy for us to do the same thing. Maybe we're not actually going to raise up swords, but we are just as much going to destroy somebody's reputation or character or deal with a perceived offense in just as destructive a way as this happened. So we do need to take the lesson. We need to look at it carefully in that respect. So let's continue on. Well, how much time do we have? I think alright, let's see if we can't get through the next chapter here in the next few minutes and see what transpires, because it's almost difficult to break the story in half. So all the children of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba, as well as from the land of Gilead, and the congregation gathered together as one man before the Lord at Mizpah. Now, how's your geographic knowledge?
Terrible.
Okay. From Dan to Beersheba means, and notice it says Dan to Beersheba. That means Dan had already settled in the north, because Dan is the northern territory. Beersheba is as far south as they were. So this is from north to south, and from, it says, Gilead, which is across the Jordan to the east. That's the settlements, you know, as far east as you can go in Israel. And then, so it's north, south, east, and we presume west. From all the 12 tribes, wherever they were, they all gathered together at Mizpah, which was a regular gathering place for Israel, by the way, and it's in the central part of the territory there. And the leaders of all the people and all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword. Wow, that's an incredible response. 400,000 men from all of Israel gathered together at Mizpah. Now the children of Benjamin heard that the children of Israel had gone up to Mizpah. What do you think they were thinking? They weren't invited. But they knew what had happened here. And so if you are in Benjamin and you realize that 400,000 men have just gathered together with their swords a little bit north, are you on edge? Wouldn't you be? So even if you were a Benjamite and you thought, you know, what these people in Gibeah did was terribly wrong, and you were willing or would have been willing to, serve on a jury or whatever it would be to bring justice, all of a sudden there are 400,000 men in arms. Now your whole attitude is not one of, hey, let's do the right thing. Now it's self-preservation, isn't it? Because this is a reactionary type of a thing, and the whole situation has suddenly just gotten inflamed radically. So the children of Benjamin heard that the children of Israel had gone up to Mizpah. And then the children of Israel said, "Tell us, how did this wicked deed happen?" And so the Levite has the opportunity to tell the story. The Levite, the husband of the woman who was murdered, answered and said, "My concubine and I went to Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin, to spend the night. The men of Gibeah rose against me and surrounded the house at night because of me. They intended to kill me, but instead they ravished my concubine so that she died. So I took hold of my concubine, cut her in pieces, and sent her throughout all the territory of the inheritance of Israel, because they committed lewdness and outrage in Israel. So because they did this horrible thing, I decided to do this horrible thing too. Look, all of you are children of Israel. Give your advice and counsel here and now." Now, I want to just pause at that point. This whole crazy situation that's going on here, whose advice did they seek? Their own. Right? The Levite did what was right in his own eyes, rather than taking it to the priest or judge or whomever. And then he gets all of these already angry people together. Take no counsel with an angry man, Proverbs tells us. And he says, now what's your advice? So if you're seeking advice, don't seek it from angry people. But that's what they did. What's your advice? Look, you're all children of Israel. You're children of Israel. So you should know. What should we do? So all the people arose as one man, saying, none of us will go to his tent, nor will any turn back to his house. But now this is the thing which we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot. We're going to destroy Gibeah. And we're going to choose, you know, who among us is going to go up first in the battle. We will take 10 men out of every 100 throughout all of the tribes of Israel, 100 out of every 1,000, and 1,000 out of every 10,000 to make provisions for the people, that when they come to Gibeah and Benjamin, they may repay all the vileness that they have done in Israel. So they sought their own advice. They didn't seek God. Did they search the Scripture to see what they should do? Apparently not. Did they inquire of the high priest to see what they should do? Nope. They just made their decision. And they said, well, everybody in Israel will be represented in this. We're all together. So all the men of Israel were gathered together against the city, united together as one man. Is it always wise to go with the crowd? This was the crowd. I mean, they all agreed. And it was all wrong. Then the tribes of Israel sent men through all the tribe of Benjamin, saying, what is this wickedness that has occurred among you? Now, therefore, deliver up the men, the perverted men who were in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and remove the evil from Israel. They were trying to remove his evil from Israel while they were engaged in this evil. But the children of Benjamin wouldn't listen to the voice of their brethren, the children of Israel. And, you know, they were wrong. They should have been united in trying to remove evil from Israel. And yet, what else could they do in the face of a posse? They felt probably compelled to defend their brethren or try to stand for some slow down, justice, whatever. They were wrong to stand altogether against this entirely, but they might not have felt like they had a lot of options because of the way the whole situation was presented. Difficult situation, certainly. Do you deliver up somebody to a lynch mob? Because that's what this was. What about deliver them to the high priest? That wasn't an option here. Was it? Wrong had been done, no question about it. But this was a posse. Even if there were ones in Benjamin that would have wanted to cooperate in rooting out whatever sin there was, I don't think they would have felt comfortable working with this angry bunch of people on their doorstep. Instead, the children of Israel, of Benjamin, it says, gathered together from their cities to Gibeah to go to battle against the children of Israel. Now, they shouldn't have done that either. And from their cities at that time, the children of Benjamin numbered 26,000 men who drew the sword. 26,000 against 400,000. This is besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who numbered another 700 select men. Among all this people were 700 select men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss. The Benjamites were known for being excellent left-handed slingers. It's recorded elsewhere in Scripture as well that they could just extremely talented. A good sling, according to some commentators, could carry its full force 200 yards. 200 yards. It was as effective in capable men as a bow and arrow at a distance like that. And so these were deadly slingers here, 700 of them. Select men who were left-handed, everyone could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss. Now, besides Benjamin, the men of Israel numbered 400,000 men and who drew the sword. All of these were men of war. And the children of Israel arose and went up to the house of God to inquire of God. Now, finally, they're going to go to God. But what did they go to God to ask God? Not should we do this in the first place. It's who should go up first in the battle. They said, which of us shall go up first to battle against the children of Israel, of Benjamin? And the Lord said, Judah first. Now, so God answered them. But what were they presenting God? Was it even a reasonable and fair question? Had they perceived the need to address God about anything in any of their decisions up to this point? And you're going to present God with a question that's founded on all kinds of wrong decisions already up to that point. I mean, think about the rationality of that. Have you ever already decided something and then gone to ask God about it? We look at this and say these people were just foolish, but don't we sometimes say, I've already decided, now I'm going to go ask God. They'd already decided what to do, and now they just wanted God to tell them who should go first. So what's God supposed to answer? You already made up your mind? I don't care. Judah. Right? They're going to do it anyway. They didn't ask God, should we do this or not? So God didn't say, don't do this. They asked him who should go first. I don't know why God picked Judah, but he said, okay, Judah first. Excuse me. It's crazy, isn't it? There are other cases in Scripture of men deciding what they want and then going to God about it, and God saying, yeah, okay, sure, go ahead. We're going to have a king. God said, you really don't want a king. Oh, we're going to have a king like everybody else in Israel. All right, if you want a king, take this one. Right? And so God goes along with it because their mind's already made up. And we see that several times, actually, in Scripture. So, does asking God mean that people are in the right attitude? Not always. James 4, verse 3. Hold your place here. James 4, verse 3. James chapter 4. Oops. Just passed it. James 4, verse 3. You ask and do not receive because you ask amiss, so that you might spend it on your pleasures. You know, sometimes we ask and we receive, but it's not necessarily the best answer because the question is wrong or the attitude is wrong. So we have to realize that just because we ask of God doesn't mean that we're in the right heart or doing the right thing. We have to go back, you know, to even finding out if we're doing the right thing in the first place. So Israel often complained that it didn't do them any good to go pray or to offer sacrifice and things like that. You know, why? What did God have to say about it? Malachi chapter 2. Malachi chapter 2 and verse 13 says, and this is the second thing you do. You cover the altar of the Lord with tears, with weeping and crying. And so he does not regard the offering anymore, nor receive it with goodwill from your hands. Why was it that God wasn't willing to answer their weeping and crying and tears and prayers? Verse 17. You have wearied the Lord with your words, and yet you say, in what way have we wearied him? In that you say, everyone who does evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and he delights in them. Or, where is the God of justice? So they're constantly questioning God, and they really should be questioning themselves, their own motives, what their own actions are. So, just because we inquire of God doesn't mean that we're inquiring rightly, doesn't mean that we're in the right attitude, or anything like that necessarily. Let's go back again to the story in Judges chapter 20. And we're going to pick it up now in verse 19. They inquired, and God answered, okay, send Judah first. So the children of Israel, verse 19, rose in the morning, and they encamped against Gibeah. And the men of Israel went out to battle against Benjamin, and the men of Israel put themselves in battle array to fight them against against them at Gibeah. And the children of Benjamin came out of Gibeah, and on that day cut down to the ground 22,000 men of Israel. At that point, you weren't real happy to be a Judahite. 22,000 men of Israel were taken out by the Benjamites in that battle. Well, God told us to go against them, didn't he? No, he just told them who to send first. And the people, that is the men of Israel, encouraged themselves again, formed the battle line at the place where they had put themselves in array on the first day. And the children of Israel went up and wept before the Lord until evening and asked counsel of the Lord, saying, "Shall I again draw near for battle against the children of my brother Benjamin?" Now they're asking, should we do this? The Lord said, sure, go up against him again. So I think he's trying to teach them a lesson at this point, isn't he? So the children of Israel approached the children of Benjamin on the second day. And Benjamin went out against them from Gibeah on the second day, cut down to the ground 18,000 more of the children of Israel. All these drew the sword. That's a costly couple of days of battle. 30,000 lost. And all the children of Israel, that is all of the people, went up and came to the house of God and wept. And they sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening, and they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. So the children of Israel inquired of the Lord. The Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, stood before it in those days. Now this is our time reference. And this is early in the period of the judges. This is not late in the period of the judges. Because Phinehas is serving, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron. And they said, "Shall I yet again go out to battle against the children of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease?" This is the first time they say brother Benjamin, so maybe they're having some misgivings. "Or shall I cease?" And the Lord said, "Go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand." And Israel set men in ambush around Gibeah, and the children of Israel went up against the children of Benjamin on the third day and put themselves in battle array against Gibeah as at other times. And so the children of Benjamin went out against the people and were drawn away from the city. And they began to strike down and kill some of the people as at other times in the highways, one of which goes up to Bethel and the other to Gibeah. And in the field, about 30 men of Israel. So this time they only got 30 people, as opposed to 18,000 or 22. And the children of Benjamin said, "They're defeated before us as at first." But the children of Israel said, "Let us flee and draw them away from the city to the highways." And so all the men of Israel rose from their place, put themselves in battle array at Baal Tamar, and then Israel's men in ambush burst forth from their position on the plain of Gibeah. It was a pincher. They drew them out of the city, suckered them into an ambush, and the Israelites that were hiding then were able to get into the city, and they burned the city behind the Benjamites when they came out after Israel. 10,000 select men from all Israel came against Gibeah, and the battle was fierce, but the Benjamites did not know that disaster was upon them. The Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel, and the children of Israel destroyed that day 25,100 Benjamites. All these drew the sword. Now, how many Benjamites were there at the start? Does anybody remember what the count was? When you look at the number here, 26,000, and here they defeated or destroyed 25,100, left 600 or so Benjamite men. They almost wiped out the entire tribe, all the men in Benjamin. So the men of Benjamin, or the children of Benjamin, saw they were defeated. Men of Israel had given ground to the Benjamites because they relied on the men in ambush whom they had set against Gibeah. And the men in ambush quickly rushed upon Gibeah. The men in ambush spread out and struck the whole city with the edge of the sword. Now the appointed signal between the men of Israel and the men in ambush was that they would make a great cloud of smoke rise up from the city, whereupon the men of Israel would turn in battle. Benjamin had begun to strike and kill about 30 of the men of Israel, for they said, "Surely they're defeated before us in battle," repeating what was said earlier here. But when the cloud began to rise from the city in a column of smoke, the Benjamites looked behind them, and there was the whole city going up in smoke. And when the men of Israel turned back, the men of Benjamin panicked, for they saw that disaster had come upon them. Therefore they turned their backs before the men of Israel in the direction of the wilderness. But the battle overtook them, and whoever came out of the cities they destroyed in their midst. They surrounded the Benjamites, chased them, and easily trampled them down as far as the front of Gibeah toward the east. And 18,000 men of Benjamin fell. All these were men of valor. They turned and fled toward the wilderness of the Rock of Rimmon. And that the Rock of Rimmon is actually a place that's still there today. It's a height on a chalky hill. And these survivors from Benjamin took refuge there. And they cut down 5,000 of them on the highways, and then they pursued them relentlessly up to Gittim, and we don't know where Gittim was, and killed 2,000 of them. So all who fell of Benjamin that day were 25,000 men who drew the sword. All these were men of valor. But 600 men turned and fled toward the wilderness to the Rock of Rimmon, and they stayed at that Rock of Rimmon for 4 months. And the men of Israel turned back against the children of Benjamin and struck them down with the edge of the sword from every city, men and beasts, all who were found. They also set fire to all the cities that they came to. They wiped out everybody they could find in all their cities. And we're going to go ahead and finish up here for time, and we'll deal with the outcome, the repercussions, or the solution to the problem that this whole thing created next time we have Bible study, when we finish in chapter 21. But what a devastating thing, because of a horrendous sin, no question, that took place. But the way everybody dealt with it was simply wrong. And sometimes you get into a situation and there's no solution to it that's a right solution, because everything that's led up to it has been wrong. How do you get out of it? It's a bad, bad deal. Okay, so next time we'll finish up with chapter 21 and get started into the next section. So, with that, thank you for waiting and being patient here, and we'll see you next time.